looking at. Although, once again, we're trying to cut down on, I guess I'll call these doors. Meeting will please come to order. This is a special meeting of the House Legislative Commons Committee. Time is 6:20, March 20th, 1986. Members present, Representative Violet and Davis, Representative Copeland, Representative Collins, and Representative Pierce. Yep, as, well, we actually don't have a bill before us. This is a work session. Informal, argue back and forth, things like that. And I'd like to work off the 3/19 draft, although we probably won't have to do that very much since we're talking more about different concepts than anything. Okay. Why don't we begin with Collins Amendment number 1. And we'll just work our way through these. I haven't been able to get in contact with people in Washington who did most of the work on this. I would like to talk with them and find out what their rationale for it was. I mean, I think there should be some type of limit on non-economic damages, but also I want to make sure that it's fair to the victims. And I'm just looking at one of your examples where current age is 57 years old. You get a maximum of $148,000. And I guess that's only on top of everything else, right? Still, if you end up as a paraplegic at 57, $148,000 just doesn't seem right. I think it's right.
I think that's going to be the problem with any formula that you come up with. I mean, there isn't going to be anything that is absolutely totally fair to everybody. And it included their figures.
Okay.
Theirs
was 0.43 times a minimum of 15 years.
Do you remember
that? I pulled out the maximum of 500, 1,000, minimum of 107,000. They were at 15 years. Their wages too are based on 20,100 for 1980.
I think one of the things, too, is that I know that about 4 years ago, an individual was awarded $500,000 for loss of consortium. It was a Fairbanks case, and it was the largest non-economic award that anyone had ever received at that time. And I think that...
how much was it?
$500,000, and it made the paper. This was the biggest that anyone had ever gotten for non-economic damages. It was for loss of consortium. And it was about 3 or 4 years ago. I think that, generally speaking, the...
that was a tangled case, I think. The guilty party had been drinking at Tommy's elbow room and trying to get his girlfriend to take the key from him. He wouldn't go off. He hit the car that had Rolf Weiss and a young lady, killed them both. His insurance company then turned around and sued the bar, which is where everything got tangled up. So Rolf, and I think, you know, the delay in the case added to the... Plus, of course, it was coincident with the entire mass. I think that jacked up the award.
I think we have to be real wary of the way all these different parts fit together and what effect that's going to have on people who are injured. Because of someone's negligence. Because under the schedule that we have in the bill now, it may or may not be changed. If you're less than 50% fault, then you get a percentage. They allocate the percentage and you can be held two times. So say someone was 30% at fault and they were the only person that was available to pay the claim, then the victim is not only going to get 60% less of his economic damages, but he's also likely only going to get 60% of non-economic damages as outlined here. And I'm just a little concerned that the way all this is going to fit together, we could potentially really be...
Well, in that position, you've got to think of the possibility of however many victims you think might end up in that case versus nobody being able to get insurance.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that...
Are we making the law for the...
We're trying to make it a fair system.
Right. And is it fair for everybody to have to lose their businesses because they can't get insurance when we require them to have insurance, so that there may sometime be a victim who you don't think gets the cause of the enumeration?
What I'm just suggesting is that we have had a system in place now for many, many years. And we've always had insurance pretty much available. All of a sudden, in 1 year, we get hit by an insurance crunch, and we're making some massive changes and in a lot of different areas. And they're all going to focus on the victim. Attorneys are still going to make their money. The insurance companies are still going to make their money. Right? All we're doing is removing the burden from the insurance companies and putting it on the big, well, actually the businesses too. I guess you have to make that argument.
No, I don't agree with it. I mean, I see what you're saying, but I don't agree with it.
Well, what I'm saying is that a lot of these things which change particular parts of our tort system by themselves are going to have an impact. And if you count them all together, they're going to have a huge impact.
And I wouldn't want to necessarily even look at the existence or non-existence of the insurance is another factor. A person may or may not have it.
Right.
And I'm looking for a system that is fair to both principal parts. I don't think insurance is an intervener.
and it's a way of, you know, covering your bets, having somebody else take responsibility for your actions. And also, it's an imponderable, because the insurance companies haven't given us any guarantee, they haven't given us any good statistics, they haven't even told us how many cases have cost them how much in the state of Alaska. Yeah, I mean, how we can't judge on an imponderable in this case. But I am concerned, you know, I mean, if I go bare, and I'm, you know, a surgeon, or I'm driving, a truck driver, you know, how great a risk am I taking? Am I going to have a fair chance in court, you know, whether or not I'm covered or not? Is it going to be fair to both parties? Is justice going to be achieved? You know, and so I do think, you know, look at some of these things.
Well, you know, I come from a slightly different place in terms of having an interest in tort reform. And it comes from my experience with the current system and how it works. And the current system and how it works is really unfair because of the vagaries of the system and the opportunities for people to just kind of ping-pong all over the place. When somebody files a suit, they'll file a suit for $1 million, but they wind up like the fellow that I worked with this summer who wound up with $17,000 in debt after litigating for several years because there are no constraints on the system. There's no direction there. That everybody played every single game that they could.
Right.
And so even though the award was large, he wound up in the whole $17,000. And he said, I've got two little kids and my wife's an alcoholic and we split up and I'm in the whole $17,000, now what do we do? I said, call the Bar Association and tell them. So the present system that we have is no jewel by any my thought in hope of refining it, and then giving it some direction is to limit some of that scatter. And I think realistically, if you increase the limit for arbitration to $75,000, by increasing that limit for arbitration, that's going to increase the number of dollars that go into that victim's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
If you do something
that
establishes a formula so that an attorney can't go out and pursue a $3 million dollar case knowing that he's lucky he's going to get $900,000, by the time he's gone through all of that, the victim's amount just keeps lowering, and this way, at least I think that there's some parameters put on the process, and I think it's going to have the effect of, even though the total volume dollars won't be as great, I think that it has the potential of putting the greatest number of dollars in the person's pocket.
But when would you open up getting out of arbitration? I mean, and going to the court. In other words, they can't settle in arbitration, but at which point, what kind of a situation? I mean, delayed realization of damages, for example. I mean, there's probably some ground. Most arbitration cases should be hard to get out of, otherwise there's no sense in having arbitration.
Well, my experience is what happens and what increases those costs is that you wind up, you have somebody who is 25 years old, is involved in an auto accident, and loses his leg. Now, at that point in time, he is physically fit because he's young. If he's any kind of a reasonable person, he's got a reasonable life. Well, as he gets dragged through this process, things get worse. You know, he starts abusing drugs, he takes pain medication, he does all of those things, and he's got two or three suicide attempts, only because he's involved for this process so long. Because people who become involved in litigation develop what I've observed that everybody will agree to, and I call it a litigation-dependent state. It's a very terrible emotional thing for people to go through, and it literally destroys them. And so what I'm saying is, as that process drags on further and further and further, you can't get a guy enough money to recover his wife and his kids and everything, and I think in the end you lose.
I read Bleak House by Charles Dickens, which is a great two generations of litigation.
It's a terrible process.
I think that's why I'm a little afraid of the effects of making all these limits. Already right now, what we have is a system that sometimes takes several years for the victim to work its way through it and finally get paid, right? Whether, in some cases, whether the claim is justified or not. It gets drug out over a period of years, okay? And finally, in some cases, it's settled for 50% of what it might actually be worth because the person has not been working, he's got a family support, he's about to lose a house, and he says the defense makes an offer, and they said, we'll give you this much. You think those people don't know the condition of those, the plaintiffs, the victims? They know what they're doing. And they say, okay, we'll give you this much. And about that time, the plaintiff's ready to jump at anything to bail himself out. And he ends up taking half of what he actually should get. Now, what we're doing here is we're making a limit. So that limit now, the maximum they're going to ever recover is going to be set down there in dollar figures. Right? It's going to be set. And unless we have binding arbitration, where they can get a quick settlement, if they get strung out for a couple of years, they're essentially getting screwed by the system once again. They get strung out for a couple of years, and the amount of settlement is already limited, what they're ever going to recover. It's not to their benefit. They'd be more than willing to settle early. But the defense is the one I can see who will want to string it out now.
Two things that I see is that if you take somebody within 6 months to a year from their accident and you give them $100,000 in cash, and you take that same person 5 years down the line and you give them double that amount of cash, because of what's happened to them in the meantime, that money isn't as valuable to them as it was in the beginning, because they've lost the ability to make decisions.
But
I'm saying to you, when it's over the length of time, you know, as the ante goes up, they don't necessarily get more of it.
Right, that's what I'm saying. We're limiting the money, and we don't know yet that the system changes we're making will work.
Well, I think Representative Pierce had an amendment the other day that would limit anything that we do for a period of 5 years. And 5 years, it can be reviewed to determine if it's had any impact,
right,
or not.
That's what I'm saying. So, well,
see, what happens, you know, what's...
Well, we can't find another legislature.
No, yeah. No, but of course we can. We can bring
all
the rest
of us come back next time
and look
for a new legislature.
Yes, we can.
It's
just like
a Senate.
You don't have to look. I think if we're going to do that, we need to look at the constitutional amendment, if that's necessary, to mandate binding arbitration. So that we can get the sell for under $75,000, or maybe even.
That would be a point.
No, not the arbitration, the Alaska statute.
Okay, that's attached to.
Your idea of arbitration. I mean, that would be. I'm very interested in that. Currently, we require the $3,000 if somebody wants.
Right. That's why the courts have implemented my
understanding. But Colin suggested raising it to 75 rather than 50.
Right.
Because if you take 40% of $50,000, that's not very much.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I would support her.
And that fact is likely not going to be a problem, because if the amount is under $75,000, I think we can do a lot of things to encourage settlements. It's the amounts that's above that have potential for being strung out.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, maybe if you were concerned about, with this kind of a scenario, having the defense string out the litigation, maybe instead of limiting it to the year that the person was injured, that you put it to the current average wage, which is automatically going to be higher because of inflation. Neil was talking about identifying which average wage year and tying it, you know, in this thing, and maybe the way then to keep the, you know, in a sense, the clock starts running, because the longer the insurance company screws around with this person, automatically, because of inflation, the ante gets higher and higher. So it's going to be to their advantage then to stop the clock from running, so that it doesn't, you know, proliferate or the numbers don't increase.
I noticed also in that section on arbitration, it limits it to arbitration shall be by a member of the Alaska Bar Association or a magistrate appointed and compensated by the court of private rights rules. I believe there are now, arbitration and mediation people, some of whom are Bar Association. members and others who are not. And arbitration is a different thing from the adversarial thing, so that should also be expanded. There are mediation and arbitration services. American Arbitration Association, for example.
Well, I think, you know, arbitration is, I know a lot of people have a problem with it, but the way that the current system is, you know, when something goes to court, you have two opposite extremes. You have the plaintiff side that says, you know, I've been injured and I'm totally incapable of doing anything and you've destroyed my life and you owe me the moon on a silver platter. And you have the defense that says, uh-uh, there's nothing the matter with you. You haven't lost a dime. You can go to work tomorrow if you want to. And the jury looks at these extremes, and whereas I think an arbitrator might be fairer, I mean, to everybody, because they...
This is what we all argue up to 130 points. But anyway, I agree with you. I just thought that allowing the court to appoint somebody other than a lawyer or a magistrate might expand the possibility. In some cases, it may not be available. But I would trust that the court would find somebody who, or would set rules that would make somebody who at least has been trained as an arbitrator. So rather than our saying that to be one thing or another, I don't know. May I ask the attorneys in the audience, what do you think about expanding the possible arbitrators by allowing the court discretion to do it by rule? And in the statute here, they do.
Oh.
This is an old statute. The limit of arbitration is $3,000. Nobody's ever done anything about it.
I think that anybody would be willing to accept, you know, people with good common sense, which is what the American Arbitration Association is concerned about. The major concern, you know, I have about arbitration is that it should really work. I mean, I agree with Representative Collins. It's a desirable idea. I just don't want it to be another level of the court system, you know, where you have to bring a case to arbitration and then appeal it to the court to start all over again. That never works for the benefit of injured parties. I'd like it to be binding, or in some way to be binding, so the parties have to bail out after it.
What if we make it binding, what level of, what particular kinds of releases might we put in there, you know?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I mean, like, normally arbitration is done between people voluntarily through a contract. You know, they agree that if something goes wrong, they'll put it to arbitration. Arbitration normally puts into situations where the people never taught each other, you know, and they have a dispute, and all of a sudden the state is telling them they have to arbitrate. There may be ways to basically penalize people who appeal from it in some way, but if they get too onerous, then you're denying them a jury trial. So, you know, yeah, whatever. I would like it to work. I think it's a really good idea. I just don't. How to make it work. I don't know how to make it binding.
Yeah,
you know, and without just costing everybody a lot of extra money and a lot of extra time. And if we can get away with that, I think it's a great idea.
Okay. I certainly agree. Let's have Collins. Could we meet in the morning? So I'm going to try to call this guy tomorrow.
I'll give you the name of the guy we've been talking to. It's Armstrong. He was the counsel to the Senate.
Do you have a copy of their bill? Your app?
Yeah,
we think it should be in the file.
What's the guy's name? Yeah,
I'm talking to him. Okay, well, I'll just
talk to him. We've been talking to Dick Armstrong, who is the counsel for the Senate.
Judiciary.
This is a very old
statute. Did he draft the language or the target? He was involved. Counsel for the Judiciary, yeah.
State Senate.
That was involved.
I was
talking with another guy. He took off after the end of the
day.
Okay, and then maybe we can meet tomorrow morning and I'll give you a call in the morning.
Okay.
Columns number two.
That's a video.
Yeah.
That was for the 317?
Yeah.
They were done for the 317.
Looking for the material.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I see.
Number two, I don't think there's any problem with that concept of the periodic payment, as long as we can work out something on it. You know, okay, number three. This is one that I don't particularly like.
Which one is it?
Your number three.
My number three?
Limitation on non-economic damages, and it says that if the plaintiff has allocated a portion of the total fall, then it's strict several liability. And with the other changes that we're making, I mean, now we're kind of going to the other extreme. If the plaintiff is 5% at fault, someone else is 95% at fault, well, he still gets 90% of it, but if three plaintiffs are 30% at fault, I mean, three defendants are 30% at fault, only one of them has money, and the plaintiff is 10% at fault, and he's really screwed up with the other changes that we're making. We're making it real onerous, I think, for them.
How do you handle it? You did handle it, I remember. Apportionment of damages.
We're doing apportionment of damages. The way it's in the bill now, it's no more than 2x percentage under 50. Also, if we're looking at the other limitations in columns number one, all those together, we're already making it. I mean, we're already having a significant impact. And I, for one, am going to be watching the insurance companies to make sure we get some type of. Columns number four. That's the arbitration thing. I don't think there's any problem with that either. Do you have a number five?
Can I ask
this four? Is there a reason for the 50 versus 75? Is that changing it to 75? I don't.
Only to increase the amount of money that goes to the plaintiff. You know, to me, the lower the amount that the person is getting, the more should go in the, we should try to maximize what that person puts in their pocket. I'm talking about the plaintiff. That's
okay. Can I amend the amendment for just for the next section allows the court to judge and to appoint and compensate?
That's something I think that we need to consider in light of whether or not that will actually work or whether that. I mean, we still have to, under that, I think, offer them access to the courts, and I'd like to know whether that's going to work or not. I don't want to just create another step. And if we have to make it binding, that's fine with me through a constitutional amendment, if that's necessary. That may be all it takes.
My suggestion is that maybe for the arbitration, what we should put in there is a screening mechanism that says that it's binding unless, say, these certain things occurred, or what's, and I don't know what those would be, but I think if we talk to some attorneys, they probably could give us some ideas of what would present a real problem to the plaintiff in arbitration.
One thing that occurred to me is, delayed medical damage. You know, someone may have had an injury that healed, but there's a deep-seated infection that doesn't come until you'll show up until later. A blow on the head that has a long-term effect that isn't evident until later. That would be a new cause. Those are about the only things really that occur to me.
Maybe one of the screeners could be a time factor. That nothing could be arbitrated before a certain time period, say 6 months or a year from date of injury. But by the end of the year from date of injury, the individual's going to be pretty stable. Maybe that would be one of the screeners, so that if, you know, somebody proceeded to take their thing to arbitration at 6 months and they had a lot of problems that were identified, that would be an option for them to go back and take it. But that would be one of the screening mechanisms to safeguard against problems developing.
But if we have, I wouldn't think somebody coming up with the idea that, well, like, later that I could have earned more money or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's what you don't want to encourage. I do agree to make it as binding as possible, but it's not entirely possible to make it completely binding.
I was going to say there is a mechanism within the workers' compensation system that when the injured worker and the insurance company come to what is called a compromise and release, and they make a final settlement, and they settle based on everything, for the wages and the medicals and all of that. I don't know what they are, but there are certain opportunities in which someone can come back. They have a two-year statute of limitations at which that any time within those 2 years that person can come back. And if there's new medical findings that are related to the incident, those are one circumstance under which the CNR can be overturned. And I said, I don't know what all of the other mechanisms are, but it seems to work real well within the workers' compensation system in terms of overturning or not overturning the CNR. And I've seen it go both ways. I've seen, you know, CNRs be overturned, a month before the 2 years runs out. So some of those things could perhaps be applied to the other.
We just want to ask workers' comp to give us. I remember we went over this about a year ago or 2 years ago, but my mind is cluttered with other things. I remember, and now this is bringing it to mind. But they probably have some of that.
It's hard to break the compromise in the release because it is binding, but it can be done based on the mechanism they currently have in place.
We could take somewhat of a dangerous course, asking the court to define, draw up rules under which it could be released from binding. I don't know. Be the best way, because they would draw the example of working.
Mm-hmm. And we might want, you know, a lesser proof than they have to go through in a workers' comp in order to have a CNR.
Okay. Only on 5? Yeah, we're on 4 now. We're on 5. I don't think.
This one is.
This is out of Washington law. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Washington statute also. Mm-hmm.
And this is the one that number 5 is the one that looks like Pearson.
Yeah, also, same as number 1 or 2, or mm-hmm. 1 was any of them. And it's, I don't know, it seems to make sense to me. I might even suggest that in cases where someone's committing a crime, that they shouldn't be allowed to recover.
There's no recovery.
That might be a good thing to answer. Washington, right? Before we go off my amendment, in looking at the language and all the information that's out there, another thought that was out there about how to limit the non-economic damages would be to use a multiplier effect of medical expenses and maybe lost income, so that instead of using...
under which one?
Well, you know, on my First Amendment, you know, I didn't try it with a scenario, but another option would be to consider, you know, tying the non-economic damages on a multiplier based on the either the medical expenses or the lost income. In other words, if you lose an income of $50,000, you're probably more unhappy than if you lose an income of $10,000, so maybe there's a rationale there.
The figures in Washington that came out when I was talking to John Connick down there about the multiplier now is that the people purporting, the that section said that the number will be between $150,000 and $450,000 caps on non-economic damages, but they're not sure of exactly how it's going to work in practice. So, it's a significant limitation.
And I thought with looking at, you know, tying it to the wages, would it be, the question of impact would most likely be higher on wages than, and be more reflective of the economy, and that's why you said.
That interest rates, what if, yeah.
There's also still minimum 15 years.
Right, is that in your amendment?
Mine is 7 years.
Hers is seven, but I'm wondering.
I'm not sure if that seven will affect the actuarial outcome of the total.
What we did is we adjusted for a range because we tried to keep it in a range, so we went on a scientific, I'm sure.
Yeah, but.
If we use the 15 years, the figures are much higher.
Right.
And.
Well, if the figures go between 150 and 450 for 15 years, they'd be between 75 and 225 for 7 years. So that's even less than the cap of 350 suggested by somebody going on.
I would favor the 15-year.
And the what?
There are the people that longer now.
We consider that, so I don't have a problem with that, switching it back to 5 years.
The whole library open, it's a time, it'll close.
Close open.
Six months open.
What's that? Are you allowing in this amendment, are you allowing derivative suits to be sued for them instead of including derivative? When you say for each incident or injury, does that mean the person can sue for the physical injury and then the loss of consortium and then the other ones? So a person could sue for $500,000 max on each one as opposed to including the derivative?
It would be all included.
So you want to include derivative?
Okay, on amendment number six, I don't think there's any problem either with having the court review whether or not the attorney's fee is reasonable, and you can add something on there to say that they can also adjust them if they really necessary.
That's it, perhaps the judge could adjust them?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would work, but.
Well, you get an option, you could say a con request in the party of the review of the attorney's fees for a reason.
And the times that I would want that would be like that situation I was describing when after all was said and done, the guy was $17,000 in debt, under those circumstances, the fee should be adjusted, I would think.
Well, I think it's a real good idea, in fact, now you can appeal the attorney's fees anywhere, so what you'd be doing is throwing it in again. It makes a lot of sense.
Do you can now?
Well, it's an appeal of attorney's fees as opposed to during the, or just an immediate post-trial request for a review of attorney's fees. This makes it, your suggestion would make it much easier to have it done.
I have a question, and one of the best things they did with the workers' comp system is when they made a change in the law, the Department of Labor prepared an information booklet that goes to each, that is distributed to each claim, and as soon as his claim comes across, they send him a letter telling him that he has his rights, and the rights are described in this little booklet, and it directs him to the Department of Labor if they have any questions, need application of any of those things. I think something like that would be helpful, and I don't know that if that's something that would be accomplished in a bill or not, but very often, people who become involved in a litigation situation don't know anything. They're like in a whole new world. They have no idea what their rights or their options are, and I'm wondering if we might not have to do it by legislation, but provide that whenever an action is filed, the plaintiff at least be provided with some information so that they know what they're, because most people wouldn't know that they could have appealed their attorney's fees if they thought they were too high, or if they wound up in the hole. Most of them wouldn't know that.
I I don't know if Legion's Cop people are required to have an attorney to represent them if they can represent themselves, but to do an attorney whenever the person filed, first of all, to file an action, they usually have an attorney. If they don't have one, they should be doing their own research if they're going to do their own work in a trial. But it's a duty of every attorney to know, to inform the plaintiff or his client of everything that's going on in the suit. If he doesn't do it, he's negligent.
So you're saying that at the present time, an attorney, if we had this amendment number 6, an attorney would say, if you really, if when this is all said and done, if you really don't like it, there's an option in the law that would allow you to have my fees. You're saying that would accept that.
Would,
you should inform. Statutorily, I don't think you necessarily ask to do it, but it is a duty. I'm thinking mostly of what it would cost to put out a booklet for every potential plaintiff that would cover every potential cause of action.
Well, the booklet's kind of, it doesn't cover every possible thing that can happen. It just kind of covers the basics, and it says, these basically are your rights. Do you have any further questions if, the situation comes up, they have a number on the board to call?
The Bar Association puts out books, little pamphlets on this is your system and this is how it works, and they're very simple, and they're usually available in the courthouses on these racks of pamphlets already. And I agree, it's almost impossible for a layman to understand exactly what goes on, but there are resources available that are pretty well spread out.
Okay, the local Pierce's Amendment number 1 is the same as your number 5. So. On number 2, it's just the legislative intent section. And Pierce. Yeah. And I agree, we probably ought to have some legislative intent. I'm not sure if this is. I really didn't get that much thought, but
it might be useful, but we can't bind another legislature. They most effective, of course, is concert. You don't want that. We really call it a call for review.
We bind for review. We could have the department review. We certainly do.
We're not
that.
Binding anyhow. It's just
the departmental review is that. Because they can report to the legislature. They would be in statute required to report on the
intent outcome. Isn't binding, it just shows the next legislature what we had intended so that if someone says, we don't need to go back and look at it, well, then they can say, well, they wanted us to, it's right here in the record, so we'll look up and put some intent language in it.
I chose 5 years
because
I thought 3 years was too soon.
Probably his binding might be too soon also.
Yeah, because it's taking his reverence, so it's after the court suspension. We're doing a lot of other things in 91, and that's what I do too.
And then my amendment is just on collateral sources, which I think kind of, and I'm not real sure that it does exactly, this was drafted by Representative Reeder after we had discussion about what we were trying to do, and the draft of the bill that he substituted didn't come up with the language that we wanted.
He didn't review that bill.
What this essentially does is allow, it prevents the double dipping, which is what we were talking about preventing. The problem is, with all the other things that we got in here, there's not going to be much double dipping, I can tell you. And on Alice's 3 amendments, I don't think there's any problems with them.
The only other one that I would add to that would be
Volunteers. Maybe.
Maybe volunteers in a certain setting, unless they've done something criminal.
I'm not sure how far we want to go with these exemptions here, because we still want to use as a segment of this risk management
And if we exempt everyone, whether volunteers or not, we might be removing the incentive for risk management.
I was thinking of the people who do and I've done it before, coach the Little League. That's what I worry about, fortunately I got hurt, the kids didn't, but it was okay. I thought that maybe one of those kids is going to get hurt and somebody's going to sue me. And I was working with the littlest girls, who just start playing and don't even know how to catch anything.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's scary. Those are neat things. To me, I think that with declining all revenues and everything, we're going to have to rely on some volunteer things, maybe a little bit more, and if people are going to be at risk.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think it has to be supplemented. If you take, there's a difference between if you're out there playing in the ball field and a child gets hurt just because you're playing ball.
Right.
In those circumstances, the person ought not to be liable. But for example, if somebody who's a coach of a team sexually abuses a child, then they ought to be taken to the cleaners. Yeah. Or killed, one of the two.
It's from a line drive from 2 feet away.
Yeah. Or something malicious,
We'll see if we can incorporate something that will address that. Representative Davis,
could you explain this in some kind of simple language of collateral benefits?
That's like if someone has, what we're trying to prevent is that if someone has, say, a health insurance policy or something, and they're already getting, or a disability policy or something, and they're already getting paid their lost wages under another program, and then we don't want to allow them to then get those benefits paid from this source over here and then go to court and sue and get the same benefits from the defendant, right, so that they're getting it twice. What we're going to do, if it's not subrogated, which means if they don't have a contract or written into the policy or something that they have subrogation rights, which means out of the settlement they can go in and collect whatever they pay out. If they don't have that subrogation rights, then we don't want them double dipping, and most of them do anyhow, but we just don't want to allow them to double dip. Say that the judgment's for $50,000 a year in lost wages and they're getting $20,000 from another source because of their disability, that'd give him a total of $70,000 when he was only making $50,000.
Yeah.
If they're
getting the $25,000 for injuries and medical costs, that wouldn't be.
I chewed that up a little, but that's basically it. Okay, then.
There is a drawback to the collateral source benefits as we drafted it, and that is that gratuitous collateral sources, a value can be attached to gratuitous collateral sources and can be deducted from an award, which kind of detracts from people. It keeps people from wanting to help other people. If your parents help you out, if your friends help you out and nurse you, the defense can attach a figure to that, a value to that, and
try to take that out.
But you can't take gratuitous collateral sources out without taking all of them except for the other banks out.
We did some research on that and found out there are a number of non-subrogated collateral sources, including the income health insurance policies. I think State Farm has some, and there are a number of other sources also aside from gratuitous sources. So,
what's the problem with it? And best we can do that.
But on the other hand, I've been involved in some circumstances where the wife charged her services, her nursing care services that she provided for the husband were charged. And an attempt was made to collect them as part of the total judgment.
Oh,
yeah. So I guess it can work both ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I still, you get hurt.
If there's any way we can take it out, I would. But I said if you can't, then all this is lost.
I'm still concerned about that because someone gets hurt, the parents pick up the tab to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't really been paid at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I mean, then it comes right out of the pocket of either the defendant or his insurance company. They get to keep the money, and the parents who step in to help out get the share.
We could maybe specifically exclude gratuitous collateral sources.
What would those most likely be? Would they be like nursing care? Maybe we could identify those to say that specifically could not be considered like nursing care.
Fire, for example, they will go around people might have apartment, try to find housing for the people and collect clothing and shelter for a while like that. So that's free. It's volunteer assistance, but if what he's saying is cash value is attached to that, then that can be deducted.
He would say that it would be specifically excluded anything that would, any requirements to meet the individual's basic needs, i.e., physical, mental, emotional, cannot. Those are the things that we'd be talking about, right? We'd be talking about the nursing care given, maybe the free guidance, free psychological counseling that would be given. Because I get that for people sometimes. I get counseling for them and all of that. And I certainly wouldn't want them to be charged for that, because if they were charged for it, they wouldn't go to it. So you'd have to exclude it to the thing.
I think gratuitous might be sufficient definition because, there isn't that much gratuitous stuff out there. Free stuff. So we just exclude free stuff and
any other comments or suggestions? Okay, we'll work on a new draft tomorrow and I'll announce on the floor tomorrow whether or not we're gonna have I'll announce whether or not the draft will be ready in time for meeting tomorrow. If not, we'll move it on Monday. So we'll kind of go ahead. Without objection, meeting's adjourned.